Hello. In tonight's Quantum Leap, cloning on the stage of Dublin's Peacock Theatre. In the run-up to Darwin Day this Monday, we ask why Charles Darwin is still so important and controversial. And we hear how the winter weather is affecting Ireland's birds. But we begin with science centres. Now, these are visitor attractions. They're usually packed with interactive science exhibits and demonstrations. They're generally aimed at children, but occasionally at adult visitors and tourists. Most capital cities have one these days. Indeed, Belfast has had one for several years, and now the Republic is catching up. Monday saw the launch of the plans for a big science centre in Dublin called Exploration Station. It's due to open in about 3 years' time, but a new science centre actually opened in County Clare today. It's the Cliffs of Moher Visitor Centre, and here to tell me why this is so scientific is architect and exhibition designer Mark Leslie. Mark, people might be surprised to hear that much of the Cliffs of Moher exhibition is actually quite scientific. So what do the themes cover?
Well, we were in the very fortunate position as exhibition designers to actually be asked to advise what the themes should be. And as I've always got a strong interest in science and science centres, I naturally took the cue from the site, where the first thing people really engage in when they walk onto the top of the Cliffs of Moher is the vastness of the Atlantic Ocean. So obviously ocean, climate change was an obvious theme. Secondly, once they've absorbed this magnificent view out to sea, they start to notice the cliffs and the extraordinary rock strata and geology of the cliffs. So obviously geology and rock would be another obvious theme for County Clare, the sort of county of rocks. And I think the third thing that people are less aware of is the extraordinary wildlife. It's Ireland's largest breeding bird colony on the ledges of the cliff, and there's a cornucopia of wonderful hidden wildlife in the waves beneath at the foot of the Cliffs of Moher. And so it's really those three themes, ocean and climate, geology and rock, and natural history, wildlife, bird and sea life were the obvious scientific themes for the centre.
Wonderful. I have to say I haven't seen it myself, but I'm looking forward to seeing it. Did you have key messages you were trying to get across?
Well, the rock strata of the Cliffs of Moher are almost like the pages of the book. They tell the story of frequent inundations of rising and sinking of the land over aeons of time. And given that we're in an era of climate change and rising ocean levels, this was an obvious theme to pick up on, because even in more very recent geological times, the extraordinary green holes and flooded undersea caves nearby the Cliffs of Moher at Doolin, a testament to extraordinary changes in sea level, even in very recent geological times. And all of this is a warning to Ireland, where, you know, even a 2 metre or a 1 metre rise in sea level could have catastrophic effects for people living around the coasts of this island.
Did you have to smuggle the science into your exhibition, or were Clare County Council very receptive?
Clare County Council were extraordinarily receptive, because I think, like everyone on the island, they're aware of the need to get children and the population at large excited and interested in science. You know, our future depends on science and technology and biotechnology, and indeed our whole lives and livelihood depend on environmental awareness and maintaining biodiversity.
Part of the exhibition, I gather, is a simulated flight over the cliffs. You can kind of take a bird's eye view, so to speak. And it means the visitors can, as it were, even if the weather's atrocious outside, can actually experience what it's like to be at this cliff edge. What kind of technology did you use to generate that simulated flight?
Funnily enough, that was the kind of concept that when we were pitching for the job against all sorts of international consultancies, that really kind of won us the job, because we said that on days when the cliffs were fogged over, we had to compensate people who'd come on the tour buses anyway and give them perhaps an experience of the cliffs that they wouldn't be able to have as humans. So I had the kind of idea of Merlin and Sword in the Stone turning people into a bird or a fish, so that people could see, experience the cliffs as a gannet would, flying along all the ledges and then plunging into the sea after fish. We originally thought we'd film that with live film work, but in reality, such as the advances of computer technology, we were able to use sort of Nemo-like Disney technology and create the whole thing in CGI.
CGI being?
Computer-generated imagery.
Okay.
The cliffs were photographed for real, and those photos were mapped onto a computer model of the cliffs to have the right contours, and then several teams of computer animators built to a high level of realism all the individual birds and animals, based on photography and film work that we'd actually done at the cliffs and based on the advice of a whole lot of local specialist naturalists and geologists.
OK, we should say that today's opening somewhat overshadowed by recent tragic events. Very quickly, what do you say to critics who say that we're taming what should be a raw and elemental experience and we're turning it into entertainment?
Well, two things. I think the Cliffs of Moher effectively were tamed as long ago as 1850 when Cornelius O'Brien built a wall and a tower along the walls, you know, we're slightly after the event now. Secondly, I've certainly always enjoyed the wildness and the solitude of the Cliffs of Moher, but in recent years this has been ruined by, you know, uncontrolled queues for sort of toilets, car parks, and the whole project has been to tidy up and make visiting the cliffs a much more pleasant experience, where the visitor centre is back from the cliffs, hidden away underground, and people's enjoyment of the cliffs. I've learnt so much from the geologists and naturalists that I, after 40 years of going to the cliffs, look at them in a completely new light now that I have a much deeper scientific understanding through researching this exhibition.
Okay, one to look forward to. Well, back in Dublin, the plans for Exploration Station, the city's long-awaited science centre, were unveiled by Taoiseach Bertie Ahern at a crowded media launch on Monday. The Quantum Leap was there, and I asked Executive Director Jane Jerry what the Exploration Station was going to be.
This is an incredibly exciting project for Ireland. This is the Republic of Ireland's first interactive science centre for children. Of course, we hope it will be appealing to people of all ages. However, it's a place where children can become involved in the exhibits and become excited about science.
It's going to be the first purpose-built interactive science centre for Dublin, certainly. I know Cork will put in its claim for having one opening in a couple of months. The project cost, you're looking to raise $15 million for the exhibits, and that's on top of building and site. And the site itself is going to be quite interesting. It's beside the Museum of Modern Art in Kilmainham, close to Collins Barracks, the National Museum, so quite a cultural centre developing there. When will it open?
We hope it will open in early 2010, so that's about 3 years from now until the day that we actually welcome visitors. We see this as an important national resource. Although it is located in Dublin, we hope to do a lot with the other science centres, which you've mentioned, as well as hopefully draw people and teachers from all over the country.
That was Jane Jerry, and the Exploration Station will open in Dublin in 3 years' time. Back in studio with me, exhibition designer Mark Leslie, the man behind the new Cliffs of Moher Centre, which opened today. Very briefly, Mark, Dublin had to wait 3 years, but I gather Cork is going to have its own science centre soon. Tell me about that.
Yes, opening in April will be Cosmos at the Castle, based at Blackrock Castle on the banks of the River Lee. And this will be a very exciting sort of astronomy and science-based centre that will tell the whole story of the evolution of the universe, but with a particular bent on it, just the search for extreme life on Earth and in space.
Excellent. Opening in Cork in April. Mark Leslie, thank you very much. We'll put web links for those three new centres on our own Quantum website. Details at the end of the programme. You're listening to The Quantum Leap with me, Mary Mulvihill. And still to come, cloning on the stage of Dublin's Peacock Theatre. But first, Monday, the February 12th, is International Darwin Day. It's the anniversary of Charles Darwin's birthday. And there are several public talks taking place over the coming few days to mark the event, as well as tours of the Natural History Museum in Dublin for adults and for children. Well, the National Museum's Darwin Day lecture is going to be given this year by zoologist Damien Walsh. And he joins me now to discuss Charles Darwin and Darwin's enduring legacy. Damien, why is Darwin so important?
Darwin is important because he produced a theory that can be described as the most revolutionary scientific idea. It not only explains why there are so many different things on the planet, it explains how they're related to each other. To quote one very famous biologist, nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. And also, more importantly, it places man in the world of nature and also explains our place in nature. So it also has some interesting theological, moral and philosophical implications as well that has meant that it has produced controversy in the last 140-odd years.
You mentioned evolution, and it's often thought, I think, that Darwin came up with the idea of evolution, and yet, of course, evolution had been around for quite some time, and his own grandfather had even written poems about it. So what exactly was Darwin's contribution?
Darwin's contribution and his legacy, as you mentioned there, is that he got it right, and that's why we still talk of Darwin. There have been many thoughts about evolution and about change, but Darwin, first and foremost, put it on a very scientific basis. He spent a lot of time thinking about change. He knew that his arguments would be resisted by certain sections of the public and by certain, even scientists and certain religious thinkers. So he described his book On the Origin of Species as one long argument. So he set out, I'm going to have to really convince the people, first and foremost, that evolution did take place. And that's what he did. He set out in an immense amount of detail through fossils, through examples of how breeding programs could change animals in, say, pigeon fanciers or dogs over a short period of time. He also produced a very plausible mechanism. The interesting thing...
And that mechanism being changed through natural selection.
Through natural selection.
Yes.
And the interesting thing is, while you had people like Darwin's own grandfather, Erasmus, and you had Lamarck postulating evolution, Darwin's theory, when he produced the On the Origin of Species, a lot of people said, yep, we've got evolution. You can see there, at last, we've got evidence for evolution. But even people who, like Huxley, for example, who were often, you know, was described as Darwin's bulldog, who were described as being very pro-Darwin, if we look historically, they weren't that interested in what we would describe as the Darwinian process, the theory of change by natural selection. So that's one of the interesting things, is when you look at historically, people are often very keen to say, yep, evolution is a fact, but we're maybe not so sure that Darwin got it right. And it's only over many years, probably about 50 years, that you get to see a real change in people's thinking and say, yep, he did get it right on the mechanism as well.
Okay, your talk is entitled From So Simple a Beginning. Where does that title come from?
Well, it's pure plagiarism. It's the last line of that very famous book On the Origin of Species, where he says, from so simple a beginning, endless forms most beautiful and wonderful have and are being evolved. And it's actually, that's the only time he comes close to mentioning the term evolution in his book. So it's plagiarism on my behalf. I'm taking the last line of Darwin's very famous work. And it's to suggest from a simple beginning, he managed to describe and produce such a revolutionary worldview. But the talk itself, it doesn't just focus on Darwin, because as you mentioned, there were other ideas before Darwin. So what kind of cultural and scientific milieu were the ideas introduced into? How were they received? And I think there's some interesting things around that. Our kind of standard Whig history of it is Darwin writes his book in 1859, biology is completely changed, Mendel's laws are rediscovered, and in 1920 you get the Neo-Darwinian synthesis, and Bob's your uncle, we've got modern biology. But it's a lot more complex than that, and I hope within the context of the talk to give some more fuller history to it and introduce the public to some characters that, unless you know some about history biology, you may not have heard about, but in their time were pretty major players in producing works on evolution.
So you're going to be covering quite a lot in that talk on Sunday afternoon. Why are you so interested in Darwin? What's the fascination?
Anyone that's studied biology is going to be interested in Darwin.
And yet there are lots of biologists out there who would deny him still.
I don't think there's many biologists would deny Darwin. They might, I'm going to try to do the impossible and not just cover almost 150 years of the legacy of the origin. I'm going to go into some detail about recent debates as well. No biologist worth their salt would deny Darwin. You know, put them up against a wall, they'll tell you, yep, evolution occurs by the theory of evolution through natural selection. What there may be some disagreement about would be the rate of evolution, the speed of evolution, and whether natural selection explains all, and whether there are other mechanisms alongside. But put them up against the wall, guaranteed, and they're going to say natural selection, okay, but maybe not everything. So there may be some disagreement about whether natural selection can actually explain every detail we see in the world. And I don't think you'll actually find any biologist, even someone who'd be called, you know, a neo-Darwinian like Richard Dawkins, would say that selection couldn't explain all. But I think most biologists would agree that it can explain pretty much everything that we're looking for.
Okay, but there are, it should be said, and recognised, some biologists who do support intelligent design, say, in the US...
I'll actually, again, in 45 minutes, I'm looking to achieve a lot. I'm looking to go maybe from the mid-17th century and an Irishman indeed who would have set out the classical date for creationism, that the earth was created on the 23rd of October in 4004 at midday.
That was Archbishop James Usher, Dublin man.
Indeed. Yes. So from his legacy right up to the very day present of intelligent design, and I want to contextualise intelligent design as being very much part of the creationist continuum. And I don't think you'd find anyone in the scientific world would say that you have what we would call practicing biologists who support intelligent design that go through the process of peer-reviewed journals. And in fact, again, not wanting to hype up the talk too much, I'm going to take apart Michael Behe's theory of irreducible complexity in 14 easy steps over the course of my presentation.
Cheney, all of that in the course of a 45-minute lecture. Damien Walsh, thank you. And Damien's lecture takes place this Sunday at 3 o'clock in the National Museum in Kildare Street. That's not the Natural History Museum, but the National Museum. And you'll find details about it and the tours that are being organised of the Natural History Museum on their website, museum.ie. And on a related note, I see that the RDS and the British Council are organising a big international panel discussion about science and religion. And that's going to take place in the RDS on March the 5th. And you'll find details of that on their website, rds.ie. Very good. Well, a play about cloning, and I say cloning, not clowning, a play about cloning, and in particular the social and personal impact of cloning, opens in Dublin's Peacock Theatre tomorrow night. It's written by a noted English playwright, Carol Churchill, and it's called A Number. The drama explores the nature-nurture debate through the relationship of a father and his three sons, some of whom, it emerges, have been cloned. All the sons are played by the same actor, and the title refers to the fact that quite a number of sons seem to have been cloned. Well, earlier, I spoke to director Annabel Cumman about the play, but before that, we joined the cast in rehearsals.
A number.
You mean?
A number of them. Of us. A considerable.
Say?
10, 20.
Didn't you ask?
I got the impression.
Why didn't you ask?
I didn't think of asking.
I can't think why not. It seems to me it would be the first thing you'd want to know. How far has this thing gone? How many of these things are there?
Good, so if it ever happens to you.
No, you're right.
No, it was stupid. It was shock. I'd known for a week before I went to the hospital, but it was still...
It is. I am. The shocking thing is that there are these. Not how many, but at all.
Even one.
Exactly, even one. A twin would be a shock.
A twin would be a surprise, but a number...
A number, any number, is a shock.
You said things. These things.
I said...
They call them things. I think we'll find they're people.
Yes, of course they are. They are, of course.
The play looks at the debate between nature and nurture in the play, basically, and those are the two kind of strong themes. It's also about the relationship between a father and his son, our sons.
Our versions of sons?
Well, they are all three different people, three different sons, but there are two sons who have been affected, their lives have been affected by Psalter, and then one whose life hasn't been affected by Psalter. And through that, we see the nurture-nature debate in the play. It's also about facing and taking responsibility for how you bring your children up or how you treat people, taking responsibility for your actions as well, I think, in the play.
What is it about the play that attracted you to it?
I'm a big fan of Carol Churchill's writing. I think the family relationship between the father and son is a very interesting one, and I think one that anyone can identify with, whether a man or a woman. I think just that relationship between a child and their parent and what that is and the complexities of that, I think is something that would touch many people, as it did myself. So, and I think the writing's fantastic in it as well. So I love her style of writing. She seems to be paring back all the time in terms of how she uses words and her dialogue as well, so...
There's no women in this for a play that is about, in some senses, reproduction and parenting, and written by a woman. There's no real mention of the mother, and it's just the two male characters. Do you find that strange? Or let me put a supplementary question, which is she talking about a future where, in cloning, to some extent, women get written out of the picture?
I think she's talking about a future where... I don't necessarily think that women get written out of the picture. She does bring mention to the mother in the play, and... the lacking of a mother in this relationship. I don't know if so much if Carol Churchill is commenting on a world without women in the family, what that means. I don't necessarily think she is, though it is marked by, I think in terms of the story, the lack of the mother is marked. But for me, I think she's writing more about a vision of where we can use science in order to evade looking and taking... responsibility for one's actions, and instead use science just to move forward, to control nature in a sense, to try and control the future, as Psalter does with his sons. He tries to shape it, fix it, and in terms of without actually looking at the repercussions of the things he has done, and looking at why, say, his young child is acting like he is, because he's lost his mother, because he's been treated appallingly badly. he decides to... So I think it's more a vision of the possible repercussions of our actions when we evade certain issues in our life, basically.
We've been talking about it as set in the future, but in a sense it isn't really. This could be today, the setting for it. And also there is actually, I would say, almost no, if indeed any, science in the play. Mm. Do you think that makes it easier to deal with the issues that something like cloning brings up?
The play is much more about the personal relationships between them. I don't think the play is about cloning per se. But I do think it's kind of like a... I think you're right, it could be set today. It's ambiguous in terms of the language where it's set. I felt she wrote this play though around the time Dolly the Sheep, I think, was first created. And it felt like a vision of the future if we don't stop and look at what we're doing in our present and don't stop and take stock, basically, of our actions.
We shouldn't forget, too, we're talking about clones in the context of this play, but there may well be many clones listening in to this radio programme, although we tend to think of them or call them identical twins. Where does Carol Churchill come down in this play on the nature versus nurture debate? What is it that makes our identity? Genes, upbringing, the mix?
I think she very strongly comes down on the nurture side of the argument. In the final scene, we have Michael Black, who hasn't been in contact or brought up by Salter. So Salter, he's been brought up by parents who we don't hear or see about. And he's happy or content, you know. And he is loved by his wife and he has a family. So we see someone who feels like he fits into the world, who feels happy in the world that he lives. And I think it's interesting, in that final scene when he is with Salter, you actually begin to see the Salter effects. So the more Salter persists in asking, are you happy, and are you not feeling angry about certain issues, the more you see how Salter's behaviour and how Salter's character is having an effect on Michael. So by the end, I think Michael is a little exhausted, and it's just getting a little touch of Salter's manner, basically, and behaviour and how it affects others. But Michael is fully rounded and loved, so you think that persists through whatever Salter's questions he might throw at him.
So that upbringing is in some respects can be stronger than genetic makeup.
And people make you who you are as well, and I think that's quite strong in the play in terms of themes, that you know, Michael says, well, there's people I love, and that is what's, you know, something deep about me. So yeah, it's very much that he's been loved, he's been brought up, and he's in an environment that he is made to feel individual. While I think with the other Salters, with his son, Salter kind of says to Bernard too, doesn't make him feel individual, because he says your identity has been undermined in a way. So his father saying that to his son is obviously devastating.
That was director Annabel Cumin. A number runs at the Peacock Theatre until March the 3rd, and next Tuesday, that's February 13th, there'll be a bioethics talk before the performance and a bioethics panel discussion after the play, and you'll find full details at the theatre website, which is abbeytheatre.ie. Now, it's time for our weekly look at the world around us, and this week we're taking a look at bird life. Joining me now on the phone is Eric Dempsey, the man behind the Birds of Ireland news website. Eric, hi there.
Good evening, Mary.
Now, Eric, we've had weird weather this autumn and winter, weeks of wind and then calm and now the recent cold spell. But tell me, is it my imagination or are there fewer birds in the gardens this winter?
Actually, what you're saying is quite correct. I've noticed that in my own garden. The main arrival of birds that we get in winter happen when Europe is gripped by very, very cold weather. And we've been reading about the weird weather that, you know, there's been no snow on the slopes in the Alps, and right across Europe there seems to be very strange weather. Birds move because they need to feed, and the main movements that take place in winter are purely to do with the fact that they need to get food. So when Europe gets gripped by cold weather, suddenly we see a big arrival of finches and thrushes and all sorts of birds into our gardens and into Ireland. If you remember last year, around this time, Europe was gripped by one of the coldest spells. I think it was minus 40 in Berlin, and that coincided with thousands upon thousands of finches and blackbirds coming into the garden. I normally would have siskins in big numbers and redpolls feeding on my nut feeders. I've only had one or two in, and only for one or two days. So I think what you're saying is quite correct.
And what about birds in Ireland that would normally leave? Did the mild autumn lull them into a false sense of security? Did a lot of them end up staying, and have they been caught by the recent cold snap?
Well, it was an interesting thing in that we have had very strange late summers. Everybody talks about Indian summers now. And the net result of that is that we have birds like swallows and house martins, which would normally, up to 10 years ago, would be well underway on their migration, their autumn migration by September. And often these birds were raising young into October. Now, it will take about 2 months for a young swallow to make their migration, but an awful lot of these birds weren't leaving Ireland until November. And of course, by the time they reach South Africa, which is the main wintering quarters for swallows in Ireland, by the time they reach there, it's time to come back. So what an awful lot of these birds are now doing is they are heading just into the Mediterranean basin. So we have a wintering population of birds like swallows now based in the Mediterranean and also in the traditional wintering sites in South Africa. So it's a very interesting thing, and it's a big gamble for these birds, because if they get hit by cold weather, say, in the Mediterranean, well, then their food supply is wiped out and that gamble is lost. It's not worth taking.
Right, so we're seeing a lot of change, a lot of flux, not just in the weather, but,
Mary,
but in
everything. I always say that birds are the greatest indicators of change, be it for good or bad. When you see something breeding in Ireland that 10 years ago you wouldn't expect to be seen in this country, something is different. And unlike, you know, trees where it takes maybe 20, 30 years to see a change in, say, times when they lose their leaves, whatever, birds have the ability to fly. And migrants will move if the weather situations or if the environment changes in any way. So birds are great indicators of change.
So the canary in the mine, so to speak.
In many ways, exactly that, yes.
Final quick question for you. Saw flocks of geese flying overhead yesterday morning through Dublin city centre. Yes. They were heading west. What am I seeing?
Well, what's happening is a few years ago, there was a lot of work being done around Dublin Bay, and it disturbed an awful lot of the geese out of their traditional feeding areas around places like the North Bull Island. And of course, geese are grazers. So what they started doing is they started leaving places like the Bull Island and started heading out to various playing pitches and fields all around Dublin City. Places like around Kimmage, I'm from Finglas originally, Johnstown Park has geese most days now up there, up in Finglas, Phoenix Park. And basically, once they started discovering this fantastic grassland, they're saying, well, why should we muck around on the Bull Island? So every morning you will now see hundreds and hundreds of brent geese leaving places like the Bull Island and going to various playing pitches around the city. And then each evening, and if anybody who lives in Dublin has a chance to do it, go down to the Bull Island just at around dusk, at about 5 o'clock around this time of year, and you'll see hundreds and hundreds of geese coming from all parts of the city and going back to the Bull Island where they'll spend the night.
Okay, I like it. Nice story. And I'm just slow. I only noticed it yesterday morning.
Well, it's a fantastic sight. And we are one of the few European capital cities that have wild geese flying within our environment.
Excellent. Eric Dempsey, thank you very much. And Eric's news website is birdsireland.com. That's it for this week. You'll find more information about the items in this week's programme on our programme website at rte.ie/radio1/quantum. And if you'd like to contact the programme, you can email us quantum@rte.ie. But until next week, from me, Mary Mulvihill, Sláinte Tamall.